In my trouble, you will answer me with your mighty hand against my enemies. Fill your purpose that you have for me. You reign forever, you won't abandon me.
1 John chapter 2, we're going to do verses 3 through 11. The book of 1 John is a book about real issues. That's kind of the tag that we're hanging on this. It's about real issues. It's about what is real. What is truth? Let's learn to live in reality. Questions like, who is God? Because people have different ideas, and which ones are right? Well, John tries to set some of that record straight. Who is God? Because people have some silly ideas. People have silly ideas about what a real Christian is like, and they're all over the map. Well, John kind of wants to set some things straight, set the record straight. So this is all about real stuff. And in fact, last week we talked about what Christians ought to be like, or what Christians are really like. We talked last week about the fact that the truth is Christians sin. There's an inconvenient truth. Some of us like to pretend that we don't, but we do. And the sooner we acknowledge the truth, the healthier it is for everybody. But we're going to launch into some new stuff this week along those same lines. What is the real Christian all about? Starting in verse 3. Now, I am titling this passage, verses 3 through 11, I am titling it, He Who Says. Now, where did I get such a title? Well, I get this title because this phrase will pop up, you can count them today, 3 times. Not once, not twice, but 3 times. How about that? Such a deal. And because this phrase occurs 3 times and only in this passage, that's like, well, maybe we should pay attention to that. And we'll talk more about this as we get on. So, that's what this passage I'm titling, verses 3 through 11, He Who Says. Verse 3. Now, by this, we know that we know Him, if we keep His commandments. Now, by this, we know that we know Him, if we keep His commandments. Now, some of you have heard this word before, but you know the New Testament was written originally in Greek. So every once in a while, it doesn't hurt if you know a little bit about Greek. It kind of helps to bring out some of the flavor of the passage. You kind of learn a little bit more. The word here is gnosko, which means to know. And it can be translated, the idea of to know. But what makes it different from other words that are translated to know is that this is knowledge by experience. Now, if I tell you that I know who the President of the United States is, you go, duh, so do I. Well, we know who the President is. We know about the President. But do you know him? Now, I don't know. We might have one or two people in here might actually have met the fellow, and that's fine. Then you could say that you know him. Now, Alan, I know who Alan is. He's sitting in front of Neil. He's sitting behind Dan. I know a little bit about Alan. I could pick him out of a crowd. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but I'm Alan's friend on Facebook. And I found out this week was Speak Like a Pirate Week. Arr! Because Alan told me that on Facebook. How about that? But that's because I have experienced a little bit Alan. So I know him. Now, this is talking about knowing God. And John says, by this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. This is talking about the relationship that we ought to be having with God. Christians will talk about this. They'll say this strange thing. They'll say, Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. And most of us go, what? What's that? What do you mean? It's not. I thought it was a religion. Well, it is kind of religion. So But it is about having a relationship with God. Not just knowing about Him, but personal experience. Knowing Him. So, John says, I know this sounds repetitious, but I've got a reason. He says, now by this we know that we know Him. Here's a quiz. Look at your Bible. I hope you got your Bible. Look at your Bible here in verse 3. This is a quiz. There's no trick questions. How many times in this verse does John say the phrase, we know? Come on. Or wherever we go, were you in first service? You know the answer. Jake wasn't. He wasn't afraid to speak up. First service took me 10 minutes for somebody to speak up with the answer. Not a trick question. You see that twice John says, we know. By this, we know that we know. You with me? What you don't know is that in the Greek, he uses two different... I'm going to use freshman English again on you. He uses two different tenses. The first we know is what we call present tense. The second we know is one of the past tenses. So, you could translate the idea something like this. By this, we now presently know that we have in the past come to know and continue to know Him if we keep His commandments. So he's saying, this is how presently we can know whether we in the past have really come to know Him. That's what he's saying. And yes, it is the second we know is perfect tense. Yes, Glenn was probably explaining this to his wife. He's describing the perfect... Yes, that's another thing. It's not... Oh, that's another... I'm sorry. I'm going to go off on rabbit trail. Say, well, not do this. What he's saying is that one of the ways that we can know with certainty about whether we have this relationship is whether we keep His commandments. And I'll just give you a clue. Keeping His commandments is a code word for obeying. It's one of the ways we know whether or not we really do know Him or have come to know Him is because of obedience. Verse 4. He who says... Wait. Verse 4. He who says... Is this a little ringing little bells? I hope somebody's saying this is ringing little bells. What did I call this passage? He who says. This might be one of those places. It is. He who says, I know Him, and does not keep His commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. The phrase, he who says, is the Greek, is translating the Greek phrase, ha legon. This is a present participle, which is like saying, he who is saying right now, I know Him, and does not keep His commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. This is the first time John will says this phrase, he who says. He's going to use it two more times in this paragraph. This phrase, the Greek phrase, ha legon, is only used three times in the book of 1 John. It's all in this paragraph. That's why it kind of sticks out, why I want to keep this paragraph together. John is challenging the reality of what these people think about themselves. He who says this, is that the truth or is that fake? Now we saw, if you were with us back in chapter 1, verses 6 through 10, we saw another triplet of phrases that sounded very similar, where John used the phrase, if we say... And do you see that in verses 6 through 10? Three times you'll see this phrase. If we say blah, 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 then blah, blah, blah. Again, if we say blah, 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 then blah, 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 blah. Here it's not if we say, here it's if he says. Back in verses 6 through 10, the challenge was on us. If we say, John's challenging us to examine ourselves. And if we say these things about ourselves, we're blowing smoke in people's face. We're pulling your leg. We're lying to you. That was then. Now he's challenging us to examine outside of ourselves and to examine other people. Now, that kind of sounds a little bit like judging people. And some of us might say, well, in Matthew 7, it says, judge not lest you be judged. You shouldn't be, don't you start judging me now. If you pay attention and actually read Matthew 7, Jesus actually does give you the permission to judge people, but only if you judge yourself first. He said, you can go ahead and pluck the splinter out of the other guy's eye, but only after you take the big honking log out of your own eye. So it is appropriate to judge people, but only if you judge yourself more carefully first. So it is kind of interesting, isn't it? That with John, if you follow the flow, he's already told us to examine ourselves. If we say, and now that we've examined ourselves, now we're going to turn outward a little bit and start looking around us. He who says, and now I'm going to examine other people. Did you follow that? Did you follow what I just said? Oh, thank you, Marissa. Thank you, thank you. One person got it. I am so thankful. Whew. So he's bringing us back to reality. What is a real Christian? And the point here, there is a lesson, and it's about real actions. Real actions. If a person really knows God, you will be able to tell by their actions and not just their words. A person's walk ought to match their talk. A person, what they do ought to match what they say. It's fine that people say things, but their lives, their actions ought to match what they say. Now, Jesus warned us about false prophets, about people who claim to be spiritual, but who are phony balonies. They're wolves in sheep's clothing. Watch what Jesus says and see how he talks about actions versus talk. In Matthew 7, Jesus says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. You see that? It's not just words, it's backing it up with actions. Verse 22, many will say to me in that, in fact, I just skipped it. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name? Look what he says. And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. That's action. That's doing. Now, don't think he's talking about that we are saved by doing good works. No. We are saved by trusting God. That's how we enter into this relationship. That's how we come to know God, is by opening up our heart to him. But it's worthwhile to test whether it was real or not. And one of the ways you can test whether it's real is whether your actions match your word. Does that make sense? The Bible will talk about these things, and people get all confused. They think, well, I guess I've got to earn my salvation. No, you trust for your salvation. But if it's real, people will see it in your life, in actions. Now, we need to be careful that we don't confuse obedience with being sinless. Because that's where people get screwed up in 1 John. We talked about this last week. That was the whole point about last week. That's why it was so awesome that John, before we get to where we're at now, where he's going to challenge our obedience, he states very clearly, look, if you think that you have no sin, you're lying. You sin. Real Christians sin. So don't think that when we're talking about obedience that we mean perfect obedience, in that you have gotten past sinning. And you will hear that from people. Well, I've been a Christian now for 20 years, and I no longer sin. How about that? I'm pretty nice, aren't I? And you can tell them by the authority of 1 John, you have just sinned because you are a liar. Okay? So don't confuse obedience with perfection in the idea that you are sinless yet. You will one day be sinless in heaven, but not yet. Now, I come up with this stupid illustration. I hope this makes sense. My illustration is about riding a bicycle up Acacia Hill. Now, the ones who are laughing are the ones who know what I'm talking about, what Acacia Hill is. That's this hill behind us. You go up Acacia, and it kind of goes slightly gently, and then all of a sudden it goes, whoop, you know, like straight up, okay? And to tell you the truth, I don't know that I've actually watched anybody ride their bike up Acacia Hill. But the other day I saw somebody riding down really, really fast. Okay, let's say, this is my little parable. Let's say riding up Acacia Hill is like obedience. It's like obeying God. If you say that you have no sin, and by the way, the disobedience, sin, is equal to gravity. So, if you say that you have no sin, then you're saying, well, you know, I don't, I just float up the hill. And one day I shall, on my bike, I've arrived because I just floated up the hill. You have not done such a thing. I have not seen anybody float up Acacia Hill. The concept of not being obedient is the person who can't conquer gravity. And they're not going to make it very far up the hill because they're not going to, they're going to give up. They're going to quit. You following me so far? But what obedience is like and what we're talking about is sometimes you got to go kind of slow. And there'll be times in your life where you don't grow like you should be. You might even slip back a little bit because if you stop pushing, where are you going to go? Yeah, well, you're going to go downhill unless you got the brakes on tight, you know. And so you push a little bit more and you go a little bit further up the hill. And then you push a little more and you're going to go a little bit further up the hill. But gang, that's what your life ought to be about if you know Him. If you know Him, you're making progress up the hill. You're not going to reach the top till we get to heaven. So you don't make perfection till, but you know what? You do keep getting further up the hill. And I got news for you. The further you get up Acacia Hill, the view is spectacular. You ought to go up Acacia Hill at sunrise. Oh my goodness. Especially like lately, there's these high clouds and the sun. Oh my, it's wonderful. It's a good thing. You keep going in the right direction. But if you're not making any progress on the hill, you ought to start asking yourself some hard questions. Who am I fooling? Because maybe I don't know God like I think I have said I do. Because if I know Him, I'm going to make some progress. I'm not talking about how fast you progress. I was talking to a really wonderful friend this morning after first service, and we were talking about his issues and his things, and he was saying, "Oh, I've got that," and I'm still struggling with this thing. But I said to him, "But you're not like you used to be, because I know what he used to be like," and he's not. He's gone up the hill a little bit, quite a bit. Verse 5. But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him. Whoever keeps his word, or code word for obey, whoever obeys, truly, the love of God is perfected in him, and by this we know that we are in him. It says the love of God is perfected in him. One of the words I want to kind of bring out is the word that's translated perfected. The Greek word is teleao, can be to make complete. I like the idea with this word of relating it to maturity or growing up. You'll see this word in James chapter 1, where James says, and James is really like one crazy, whacked out dude. I mean, if you don't think he's crazy, read this. He says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials." He said, throw a party when life gets tough. Now, don't you agree that he's sick? Right? But he says this, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, but let patience have its perfect work, that, and that's this word, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Now, we know that whatever he's talking about, he's not talking about perfect, but he's talking about maturity. He's talking about growing up. And gang, that is one of the chief ways God grows us up, is by getting through hard times. There still may be one or two of you in here who think that becoming a Christian means you don't have to worry about hard times anymore. No, my friend, I am so sorry. That's not true. God doesn't promise to take away your hard times. Sometimes he does. Sometimes he takes them away. But sometimes he knows that you and I need to get through this. We need to go through this. Some of you are going through a little more than others. And you know what? This is how we grow. This is how we grow, is figuring it out, learning the lessons, learning patience. Oh my gosh, sometimes I do not want to be patient with people. But as I grow in patience, my walk with the Lord matures. I grow up. I grow up. I don't throw the temper tantrums I used to when I was 2 years old, because I'm maturing because of difficulties. Now, I've gone on a little bit of a rabbit trail, because that's not exactly where John's going, but John uses this word for maturity. And look what John says. John says, whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected. Or he's talking about mature love. Our obedience in the Lord matures, or it helps us to experience God's love in a mature way, in a deeper way. It's not just about you learning to love God better, but this is about you experiencing God's love in a deeper way. If you've got a Bible, I want you to turn to John chapter 14, because you're going to want to know where this passage is. So you may want to turn down your page. If you've got a Kindle or an iPad or something, you put a little bookmark in it, because you're going to want to go back here or highlight the text or whatever you're going to do. John chapter 14, verses 21 to 23. Jesus taught this same principle, the principle of obedience being tied to a deeper love thing with God. John 14, 21, Jesus says this. This is the Gospel of John. Jesus said this, he who has my commandments and keeps them, or obeys, it is he who loves me, and he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. You get to know him in a deeper way. To manifest himself to us, that means we get to know him better, deeper. Judas, not Iscariot, verse 22, said to him, Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world? Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. See, there's a response that when my love for God is being translated into obedience to God, God's love back, I don't want to say it grows, because I don't want you to think that God's love for you is conditional. I don't want you to think that, well, you know, God's not going to love you if you don't obey him. That's not where I'm going with this. Because God's love is unconditional. But gang, sometimes God's love has a hard time breaking through. And as I learn to obey him, it's like the covers are taken off. It's like the protective coating is being taken off of my life. And I experience more the love of God when I learn to obey. Oh, it's so important to learn to not just... I mean, it's cool that you come to church. It's cool that you read your Bible. But gang, maturity comes when I start doing what he says, and then my walk with him goes deeper. I experience more and more the love of God. This kind of love, love that is reflected in obedience and doing the right thing, it kind of works that way in our families. Sometimes you simply have to do the right thing, even when it's inconvenient, but you do it because you love them. Yet you do this in our families. Watch this video.
You're passing. You got to support the puck. Do I have to tell you this? And we're getting killed on the board.
Hello.
This is your territory, Grimson. Do your job.
Grimson.
Hello?
Oh, hi, honey.
What? Al? All right. The itsy bitsy spider climbed up the water spout. Down came the rain and washed the spider out. Out came the sun and dried up all the rain. And the itsy bitsy spider climbed up the spout again.
I love you, Daddy.
I love you too, sweetheart.
Hey, it's my girl.
Love. Pass it on. A message from the Foundation for a Better Life.
I like that video. You can bet that dad's going to develop a mature, loving relationship with his daughter because it's more important that he does the right thing than he be embarrassed or that somebody teases him. It was more important for him to do the right thing. That's obedience. That's obedience. Doing the right thing. And doing the right thing is hand in hand. It connects to God's love. So, beloved, we obey. We obey. We do what He wants. And we grow in love for Him. Obedience brings deeper love. We experience His love deeper. Verse 6. He who says... Wait. That sounds kind of familiar. Verse 6. He who says... Wait. Do you know what I'm talking about? Remember what this passage was titled? He who says. Here's that verse. Here it is. He who says he abides in him ought himself also to walk just as he walked. There's that ha legon again. This is the second time that Jesus is... or that John's using this phrase. He's, again, trying to bring us back to reality. What's real? What's not? What's true? What's right? What's not? He who says, but what does it mean to abide in him? He who says he abides in him ought himself also to walk as he just as he walked. The word abide, Greek word is meno. It can mean to remain. I think remain probably comes from meno. To remain, to abide. It means to stay put. It means to just stay where you are. Jesus used the same word to describe the relationship between him and the believer. He used the idea when he talked about a vine and branches. This is in John chapter 15, that he's the vine, we're the branches, and we need to abide in him. Now, that's not something magical. That means you just stay put. You just stay connected. He said in John 15, I think the ladies are going to be doing a little bit of John 15 at the ladies' retreat. I can hardly wait to see how it's all going to come out. John 15, 5, Jesus says, I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing. Abiding's a big deal. There is nothing magical about it. The idea is I've established this relationship with him. So stay there. Stay put. And because he, as the vine, has life in him, sap, and because you're connected with him, guess what? That life starts to flow in you. And that life in him produces fruit, not you. You don't produce fruit. You produce fruit because he does it in you. Fruit is results. It produces something, a changed life. It produces results only because I'm connected to him. So back to our text. John says, he who says he abides in him ought himself also to walk just as he walked. Because see, if I'm connected to this guy and I got the same life that's in him is starting to pump into me, well, then some of it might leak out. And people might start seeing his life working through mine. Jesus lived a life of obedience. He said, I always do that which pleases the Father. And with that kind of life is pumping into you because of your connection, guess what? It produces obedience. We have to walk just as he walked. And I want to call a lesson here. I want to call it loving portrait. And try to follow me where I'm going with this. If we act like Jesus, it's kind of like we're painting a picture to the world of who Jesus is. I think God made a mistake doing it this way. But for some reason, one of the ways that God prefers for people to know who he is like is by working through his people. Now, I think that that's quite flawed, personally. I think you should send angels and do nuclear bombs and all these kind of things. Great thing, you'll part Red Seas, all that kind of stuff. But that's not what he does. Instead, he works in you and expects you and me to look like him, to walk just as he walked. So if I'm connected to him and his life's flowing through me, then I'm going to start acting a little more like him. I'm painting a portrait of Jesus. The problem is some of us don't paint very well. And we don't do a good job of painting a picture like Jesus. Now, I don't know if you've followed this thing in the news, but there's a big thing happening in Spain, the little town of Borja, Spain. There is a church there in Borja, Spain. And this is an 80-year-old, lovely 80-year-old lady who decided that she could paint. There is a famous painting, apparently. It's called Ecce Homo, Behold the Man. It was painted in 1930 by a famous Spanish artist, a fresco, Mom. It was a fresco, which means it was painted in the plaster on the wall. But it is getting kind of old. It's almost 100 years. It's starting to decay. And this woman decided to take it upon herself to restore this. She is not a professional art restoration person. Let's say she didn't do a very good job. She botched the job. This restoration project is some people aren't calling it Ecce Homo, they're calling it Ecce Mono, which they're saying is short for Behold the Monkey instead of Behold the Man. The BBC described it as looking like a crayon sketch of a very hairy monkey in an ill-fitting tunic. Now, that's the original. That's what it's supposed to look, or that's where what she started working on.
We've always repaired everything here. Did somebody tell you to do this? Yeah, of course. It was the priest. The priest knew it. He did.
You did it secretly, didn't you?
No. No, of course not. Everybody who came into the church could see I was painting.
There's the original. Here's her version.
Hasta ahora solamente había tocado lo que es la túnica.
Until now, she had just painted the tunic. But the problem started when she painted on the head as well, because she has destroyed this painting.
Some professional restorers are coming soon, and they'll try to give us advice and guidance on how to deal with the painting now.
También nos aconsejen sobre qué se puede hacer.
You know what's even odder is that once the video began to hit on the internet of this, it's gotten kind of crazy, because now the botched painting has become a tourist draw, and people are lining up, and they're charging $1 a head to come and see this thing, and like 1,000 people standing in line. Actually quite crazy, the whole thing. And the woman has actually filed a lawsuit because she wants to have some, she's the one that painted it. And the church is collecting all this money. She didn't want the money for herself. She wants it to go to a charity. But it's just a crazy, crazy thing. And now the church isn't sure whether they really want to restore it or not, because this is such a tourist draw. Meanwhile, the people are seeing the wrong picture. They're getting the wrong idea. This is not the way the picture should look. She screwed up the picture. The one who knows him ought to walk like he walked. We ought to be painting the right picture. Now, the issue is not just obedience, but we're going to see he's going to transition because he's going to make it a little practical. The issue is actually going to be a little bit harsher, a little more strict, a little more specific. And he's going to talk about the issue of loving other people. Are we painting the right picture in how we love other people? Look at verse 7. Brethren, I write no new commandment to you, but an old commandment which you have had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word which you have heard from the beginning. Now, I know this is going to get confusing. Let me just cut to the quick. And the commandment is about love. We know this from 2 John verse 5, where he talks about the new commandment that I gave you a long time ago. You've had it from the beginning. The commandment is that we love one another. John's readers, from the very beginning of being Christians, they've always heard that they need to love one another. So, in a sense, it is an old commandment. Verse 8, again, a new commandment I write to you, which thing is true in him and in you, because the darkness is shining away and the true light is already shining. Now, old commandment, new commandment, what are you talking about? Again, I know. Let me just cut to the chase. Instead of giving you all the proofs, he is talking about the same thing. It's an old commandment because you've had it from the beginning. But it's a new commandment because this is the commandment that Jesus gave us. And he called it a fresh commandment in John 13:34, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. It's an old commandment, but it's still kind of new. You've got to learn how to do this. This is the issue. Jesus demonstrated his love for us by dying for us, by laying down his life for us. He didn't just send us roses. He didn't kiss us on the cheek. He didn't get us the new toy we wanted. He died for us. That's a serious kind of love. That's a heavy kind of love. We ought to love one another. Verse 9. Now it gets a little more convicting. He who says... There's our phrase again. He who says, here's the third time, here's another challenge, of reality challenge. He who says he is in the light, we've talked about being in the light because the first chapter talked about God is light, and when we come to know him, we ought to be in the light. So it's talking about the same thing. He says, he who says he is in the light and hates his brother is in darkness until now. He who hates his brother. This is the specific. This is one of the issues, big issues, of whether you get the portrait right. Whether your life is loving people or hating them. Verse 10, he who loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no cause for stumbling in him. He who loves his brother abides in the light. And there is no cause for stumbling in him. There's a lesson here. I want to call it loving restraint. In Romans chapter 14, Paul talks about what we might call gray issues. You know, there are some things that are black and white as Christians. There are some things that are right, and there's some things that are wrong. Yes. But there are some things that are very gray. And it kind of depends on the situation. Kind of depends on the time and the place. For Paul, the issue on the day was ribs. Barbecued spare ribs. I don't know if those are Lucille's or not, but no, it's not about, but it was about meat. The issue was about meat, whether you should eat meat that is sacrificed to idols. Because in those days, you got the cheaper meat out back behind Aphrodite's temple. you know, your neighbor Joe down the street wanted to sacrifice a cow to Aphrodite, and they make the sacrifice. Well, guess what they do with the meat afterwards? They sell it in the back, real cheap. Now, the people who grew up worshiping idols, when they're watching you eat your spare ribs that you got real cheap, and wonder, how come you got meat every night? How did you do this? You know, how could you afford this? The meat's dirt cheap down behind Aphrodite's temple. They start thinking, wait a minute, that's like you're worshiping those gods. And for those people, it was wrong. But there were some other believers who were a little bit smarter to realize there really is no Aphrodite. It's a bunch of hooey. It's a sham. There's only one true and living God. And shoot, if I can save some of God's money by buying it at Aphrodite's Alpha Beta, why don't I do that instead of going to Albertsons where I'm paying twice the price, you know? Why should I do that? It just makes more sense. So there's these two issues. Is it right or is it wrong? Well, when Paul talks about this, so some people ate meat, some people ate veggies. Paul's point is this. He said, as believers, we ought to let love restrain our actions. He says in Romans 14, verse 15, yet if your brother is grieved because of your food, you are no longer walking in love. Do not destroy with your food the one for whom Christ died. Sometimes, because maybe it's a gray issue, maybe I could do it, maybe I don't have to do it, but if somebody else has stumbled by my action, if I love them, I'm not going to do it. I love ribs. I'm not that fond of vegetables. But this isn't fair. I have freedom to eat ribs. Yeah, but if you're stumbled by it, and if I love you, I will say, sorry, that's no... Now, what does that look like nowadays? Because we don't have Aphrodite's temple. And I'm sorry to give some of you this ammunition. Did you know that the Bible does not prohibit drinking alcohol? Don't go... It doesn't. The Bible talks about wine. Jesus turned water into Welch's grape juice. No. He turned it into wine. The Bible doesn't prohibit drinking alcohol. The Bible does prohibit drunkenness. Now, so you go to Olive Garden. I go to Olive Garden. We're sitting, you know, across from each other while we're getting served. You ordered chicken parmesan. I order chicken parmesan. And as your chicken parm comes and my chicken parm comes, and the waitress comes and pours me my glass of red wine. And let's say you are one of the, actually we have quite a few of you of who I'm very proud of, who have struggled with alcohol. Some people might call you an alcoholic. And there you are watching your pastor and his red wine. And you're thinking, what? Well, you know what? That's one of the reasons why you're not going to see me order red wine at Olive Garden. You can. I don't have a problem with you doing it. But I'm not going to do it. Why? Because love restrains. Love restrains. So, John says, what did he say here? He says, he who loves his brother abides in the light, and there's no cause for stumbling in him. Because that's what love looks like. I'll restrain my freedoms because it's the right thing. Because I love you. Love restrains. Verse 11, or last verse. But he who hates his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness and does not know where he is going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. You know, the sad thing is, gang, is that a lot of the world looks at us as Christians and they don't see us loving people. They see us hating people. I've got an interesting video about what people search for on the worldwide interweb that a very good friend showed me, include me, and I want to show this to you. It leaves out a few things, because I'll explain it in a minute, but look how people look when they're wanting to know why Christians do or are certain ways. I tested this before I showed it to you and put in the letters. Those words do show up. Now, what they don't show is there's a few nice things about Christians in there, too. So there are a few nice things. But this is true. This is what people are wondering. Why are we jerks? Why do we hate people? Well, gang, we're not supposed to hate people. He who hates his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness, but does not know where he's going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. Jesus said the world ought to see something different in us. He said in John 13:35, by this all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. That's when we paint the picture correctly. And people look at the picture and watch us loving people and they go, wow, that looks just like Jesus. Because that's the way it's supposed to look. It's by loving people. Now it says, the one who hates his brother is in darkness, walks in darkness, and does not know where he is going because the darkness has blinded his eye. Because that's what happens when you walk in the dark. You don't know where you're going. The darker it is, you don't know where you're going. There's a lesson here, and I'm going to call this lesson loving guidance. The one who hates has lost his way. He doesn't have a true sense of direction because he can't see. Now, I got to tell you, a question I get asked as a pastor all the time is, what is God's will for me? And usually people want to know, am I supposed to marry this girl or not? Yeah, it's, you know, but it's all kinds of things. People want to know, what is God's will? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to go left or right? And I don't always like those questions because, to tell you the truth, I'm not going to tell you how to live your life. I'll give you the principles. I'll give you some guidance. But one of these issues is, what is God's will for my life? Well, here's something you can throw into your hopper when you're trying to figure out which one is God's way. Am I acting out of love? Because if I'm acting out of hate, the lights go out and I wander in the darkness and I won't have a clue about God's love. You hear what I'm saying? I don't have to have some kind of magical ESP thing going on here, gang, or we would call it a word of knowledge. There are some of you who flat out hate people. And guess where that puts you? Bumping into things. On the other hand, if you walk in love, learning what it means, and some of your preconceived ideas about love are wrong too, by the way. We got to figure out what it looks like. But if I learn to walk in love, hey, I'm in his light. And I'll figure things out a little easier, because I'm walking in love. Some of you need to abandon this bitterness, the hatred that you're holding on to. because you're hurting yourself and you're hurting people around you. And Jesus doesn't look like Jesus. He looks like Monkey Boy. He does. Why do you think they ask us stupid questions about Christians? Because we're painting Monkey Boy all the time instead of showing them Jesus. I'm going to try to do an Irish accent. It may sound a bit Scottish, but forgive me. 'Twas a dark night in the Irish woods, and a woman had gone into labor. The doctor was called out to assist with the delivery. To keep the nervous father-to-be busy, the doctor hands him a lantern and says, "Here, laddie, hold this high so I can see what I'm about." Soon, a wee baby boy was brought into the world. As the father started to put down the lantern, the doctor said, "Hold the lantern high, laddie. I think there is yet another wee bairn to come." Sure enough, within minutes, he delivered a bonny lass. "Not don't be in a hurry to be putting down that lantern, lad. It seems there's yet another one besides," cried the doctor. The nervous father scratched his head in bewilderment and asked the doctor, "Sir, do you think 'tis the light that's attracting them?" Sometimes we have the wrong idea about what light does in our lives. Sometimes, and it sounds to me like the father was thinking, this is just causing more and more trouble. I should put the light down. Maybe the babies will stop coming, you know. Sometimes we think that God's light is causing us trouble. Gang, it's the kind of trouble you want. It's the maturity you want. It's the growing up. It's the truth that you want. You need to stop hating. You need to stop hating. How do I do that? Well, I got 10 magic steps for how to stop hating. I don't think I got that. Well, maybe it starts by you acknowledging it today in your heart. And start asking God, help me change. I've got to get out of this darkness. You have got to get out of this darkness. Let's stand and pray.